happen through the revolutionary Iranians and the more moderate version of Islam is the issue, and it terrifies the kings in Mecca and so forth, and what they're holding on to, because this thing could slip away. They have a population of about, out of the 26 million people, about a third of them are Shia, and they all sit on the oil fields. So you have a really explosive thing that can happen if Iran starts taking off. This agreement scares the hell out of these people, and at the same time, they're going to work hard to get another Bush into the presidency to put an end to this stuff.
Well, you know, the Saudi regime is a corrupt, immoral, parasitical regime. And as you point out, they are the global sponsors of jihadist terrorism through their funding of madrasas and also arms trafficking through Turkey and Afghanistan. Now, the Yemen situation is an interesting one, because the Houthi rebels who were taking over Yemen, they were Shia, but they had no connection to Iran.
Yeah.
They were anti-Saudi Shia. They were also anti-Al-Qaeda, and they were effectively cutting out the Al-Qaeda forces that supposedly we were attacking. By supporting the Saudi bombing of the Houthi rebels, Al-Qaeda has now regained their foothold in Yemen. And remember, President Obama said that Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, which is Yemen, is the most dangerous to American interests.
For the life of me, I cannot understand our supporting the bombing of Yemen and giving weaponry and planes and so forth.
But this is why, Augie, you have to go to this higher strategic question.
Right.
What is U.S. policy in this area? And it's regime change and destabilization in defense of a Saudi-Israeli axis.
Oh, my God.
And that's why McCain and others brought Netanyahu, and Boehner brought Netanyahu, to say, forget Al-Qaeda, the real threat to the United States is Iran. But the Iranians are only in other countries to fight Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
Yeah.
They're not trying to take over Iraq or Syria.
Now, you know, you've got a really interesting convergence here that could develop and openly challenge what we're doing. Once this deal is sealed, it's going to be the telltale turning of the worm, if you will. And that is the Shia of the south of Iraq announcing their relationship with and denouncing their relationship with Baghdad at the same time with Tehran, and then coming around and saying, and by the way, we are embracing the Kurds and their interests. We share their interests in the anti-ISIS thing, and announce it to the world. It's going to be tough for us to do what we're continuing to have done.
Well, except for the fact that outside of a few voices, most Americans are not being told what's happening.
Yeah.
We're told that Iran is the equivalent of Al-Qaeda, or worse, and that the Iranians are about to build a nuclear bomb and they're going to blow up Israel and threaten the United States. And this kind of disinformation is what...
It's also the information that denies the fact that the Iranians have not started a single aggressive act of that sort. And they say, well, when you tell them that, people are like, well, they support Hezbollah, or they support... Well, Hezbollah defends itself against the ongoing assaults of the Israeli Air Force and try to maintain some kind of civility in Lebanon. I mean, this nonsense has got to be a moneymaker for somebody, because it makes no sense any other way.
Let me check something here, Harley.
Okay.
It's interesting talking to people from Iran. A lot of Americans don't realize this. Nobody can speak Farsi or Arabic in America, or almost nobody. But in Iran, a lot of the people speak English. For instance, if you were to take a graduate level course, let's say in chemistry, your curriculum and your books are written in English.
Yeah.
A lot of the upper class Iranians speak English. It's the international language. They wear our clothes. They respect our customs. They welcome Americans that they meet individually. Now, our political leaders are different in both countries. They seek to fan the flames of war. But the actual individual people of Iran do not hate Americans. But Americans, a lot of them simply find that Iranians are bad for some particular reason without really knowing what the people are like. It's just such a tragedy. We don't realize that so many of them speak English and want to be friends with America. Yes, there is this political element, but there's a whole different situation going on there in real life.
No, you're absolutely right. The Iranian population on the whole is pro-American. And the Iranian population, by the way, the idea that the Iranians want to wipe out Israel is also just the, I mean, Ahmadinejad was a hothead who threw out all this rhetoric. There are synagogues functioning in Tehran. The Jewish people in Iran, just as in Syria, have been protected by the government. And in fact, the people that we're supporting, the ISIS and others, are the ones who are threatening to exterminate Jews and Christians in those countries. So the ironies just abound. But unfortunately, most Americans aren't clued into this. As you point out, very few people know that the Iranians are not Arabs. They're Persians.
That is a totally different animal. And that means, and now, on that point, the Shia of the southern Iraq, now, are they Arabs or are they just Shia by religion?
No, they're Arabs. They're culturally what we would call Iraqis since the beginning of the 20th century. The important thing is that when we're told that these people have been fighting each other for centuries, it's just not true. Before the British came into the Middle East in the 1880s, with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, there was a long period of peace between Shia and Sunni in all of these countries. Now, it got inflamed, going back to your old buddy Ronald Reagan, it got inflamed between Iran and Iraq during a war that was encouraged by the United States as part of an oil question.
Yes.
And so they used the divisions between Shia and Sunni to have the Sunni regime in Baghdad at war with the Shia regime in the Iranian Republic. Now, we supported initially Iraq. We armed them. We provided them the so-called poisonous gas that was used by the Iraqis in the battlefield against Iran. And then when the Iraqis started winning, Oliver North went to Iran to work a deal with the Iranians. And we started arming Iran.
But the deal that North was involved in, wasn't that not called Iran-Contra?
Exactly. Yeah. And that was Reagan should have been impeached for that, because that was a constitutional violation. He lied to the American people and conducted warfare that led to over a million Iranians were killed in that war, and they say about 250,000 Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And for what purpose? No one seems to know.
Well, the purpose had to have been money, because and the Bush connections and the power that they involved themselves with. It was my understanding that Southern Airways, which flew a lot of the weaponry and the drugs back and forth out of Miami, was run by Jeb Bush. And so this
Southern Air Transport, which was a CIA proprietary operation, was involved in this.
Yeah.
I don't know Jeb Bush's personal connection, but George Bush Sr. from the White House was running the whole Iran-Contra operation. You know, by that time, remember, Reagan was somewhat weakened following the assassination attempt and maybe even early onset of Alzheimer's. And Bush was running most of the significant policies for the Reagan administration.
Well, it must have been curious for him to look in the mirror in the morning and say, all I said was voodoo.
We're going to take a commercial break right now, and we'll be back shortly after this, so just hang in here, if you will, and listen to one of our sponsors.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato, 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too. This part of the Morning Edge is brought to you by Callens, Little, and Delgado, practicing personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Call 941-749-1446.
941-749-1446. I may be crazy, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. Turn out the light. And we are back, and we are speaking with Harley Slanger from the LaRouche Pack. Harley, welcome back to the Morning Edge, and here is Augie back at, well, still alive, barely.
I don't want to laugh, because I've got a deep cold, but voodoo economics is echoes in the primary against Ronald Reagan when Bush was running against him.
Right.
And the whole scenario of bringing in his approach to government. Government's the problem, not the solution. All this echoing of nonsensical stuff. And to this day now, we have Donald Trump. And Trump is such an interesting character. But what do you think will happen, or what do you think you can get done in regard to the unnecessary act of war that the Obama administration has carried out? The fact that Petraeus got a slap on the finger, a punishment for his shenanigans under the desk with his twin girlfriend, and the releasing of classified stuff, this overclassification stuff. Does it excuse Petraeus? Does it excuse Hillary? Does it excuse 9/11 with the 28 pages, you know?
Well, it definitely shows a double standard. The Petraeus thing is a perfect example where you have someone who you didn't even need a whistleblower. I mean, he basically, to put it in a strange way, he blew himself. And it blew up in the public, and he got a slap on the wrist. Whereas there are people going to jail for reporting illegal activities of the U.S. government, including the CIA. Now, that brings up the question of Hillary. And I think the Republicans who are going after Hillary are doing a great disservice to this country, not because she shouldn't be held accountable, but that she was merely defending the policy of her boss, and the Republicans are afraid to go after Obama.
Well, Harley, now, let's look at that. How would you hold her accountable?
Well, the important question that I think is the first explosive point is that it's now clear that the administration's talking points on Benghazi were a lie. They knew from the beginning this was an al-Qaeda attack. Ansar al-Sharia carried out the attack on Benghazi on September 11, 2012. That's in the Defense Intelligence Agency documents that were released within an hour of the attack. And yet, Susan Rice, 5 days later, went on television and lied about it. Hillary backed up that lie. Why? Because Obama's presidential campaign was about how al-Qaeda was on the run and we've defeated them. So that's a question of a simple lie. And there are documents that the State Department's releasing that will show whether or not Hillary Clinton knew that at the time she said it.
Well,
now, if she did,
that can be excused. I mean, the truth is that he thought they were on the run. We've had these hydras with the multi-heads popping up in al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, all of them.
Except Augie for the other part of that story, which is that we got rid of Gaddafi to defend al-Qaeda, which is what the Defense Intelligence Agency documents also say, that Gaddafi was out to crush the al-Qaeda cells in Derna and Benghazi. And that was the point at which Cameron organized this Sarkozy-Cameron Obama alliance to destroy the Gaddafi government and kill Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so then, why would we be surprised that al-Qaeda takes over Tripoli and al-Qaeda is attacking us, American interests, in Benghazi? So you see, there's a whole package here. But I wanted to get to the deeper point, Augie, which is this plays right into this question of why is President Obama continuing to censor the 28 pages from the original Congressional Intelligence Report, the Senate Intelligence Report, on the Saudi role in 9/11.
That is the strangest thing. And I think what needs to happen, and you guys might be the ones to do it, get with the families who are pleading for the release and opening up of this. There needs to be a picketing at the United Nations about what we're doing in the White House. Something.
Well, in fact, the families of the victims of 9/11 have held several press conferences with us and with Senator Graham, the former senator from Florida, who's courageously been continuing this fight.
Right.
There's a bill in the House with Democrat and Republican sponsors, Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, a Democrat, and Walter Jones of North Carolina, a Republican. And Rand Paul introduced a companion bill in the Senate to release the 28 pages. Now, there's another reason why this is so important, called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which seems to have blown apart over the weekend because the number of our so-called partners didn't want to sign it. But why do we have secret documents that even the Congress can't see, that they're supposed to vote on? And President Obama is the one responsible for classifying the treaty, the so-called treaty of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And when the vote came up in the Senate, it was all the Republicans and Obama against almost all the Democrats, but they did get 13 Democrats to vote for the fast track to give Obama a temporary victory, a Pyrrhic victory, so to speak, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Why do you call it Pyrrhic?
Well, because the treaty just fell apart this weekend. Because there are so many contradictions in it. One of the issues is the power of corporations to override national government restrictions. For example, on pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceutical companies under the Trans-Pacific Partnership can continue patents so they will not provide cheap medicines to countries where they're necessary. So the Indians, the Japanese, and the Australians won't sign that because they refuse to have medication that's life-saving. According to Doctors Without Borders, 1.5 billion people will be denied life-saving medication because of the patent rights of the pharmaceutical companies.
So again, the corporations have really stepped all over things, and they
exactly
would have made that much easier.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So I think if you look in the pages of the New York Times, there's an article today about how the Trans-Pacific Partnership was blown out of the water by this failure to get an agreement over the weekend.
And it should have been. Again, as you said, it gave the corporations more power than individual countries that it was supposed to regulate. Gave power to the corporations. It does sound like a familiar theme going on. Corporations, you know, whether it's the electoral system that we now allow to have, the corporations are super citizens. And that's just amazing what Citizens United gave corporate power the right to overwhelm the vote of the common man. They say that 400 families in the United States now have more power than almost the entire population. They are funding virtually every Republican candidate, Democratic candidate right now in the government. They are putting 90% of all the funds in. 400 families. We have the best government money can buy.
Well, and to just make that point more clear, it's Wall Street which is opposing Glass-Steagall, because the banks that are too big to fail don't want to fail. They want to use the government to bail them out. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would override U.S. government protections, including things like genetically modified seeds, the whole question of the pharmacy industry, banking, and so on.
The fly in the ointment on a lot of this is what the Europeans are starting to look at with regard to these agreements. They don't want to get drug into a corner, especially on the GMO, genetically modified stuff.
Organisms,
whatever you have.
Well, and the other problem is that the Europeans themselves are having to deal with the same problem of a handful of banks in the city of London and Paris dictating the terms to the poorer countries in Europe through the International Monetary Fund, which has admitted in its own secret memos which were leaked to the public, that their policies are failing, that the five-year policy of austerity in Greece has in fact shrunk the economy by 25% and made the debt burden of Greece unsustainable. So what's the solution? More of the same.
Yeah.
And this is what you get. But this is what you get when you have a corporate oligarchy interlocking boards of directors that are dictating policies to governments. And that's why we have to re-empower the government to act to regulate these private interests. That was what our American Revolution was about, not devolving the power of a central government. You go back to the debate at the U.S. Constitutional Convention, and what was the issue? It was the implied powers of government to act on behalf of the entire population against private interests. That's what the American Revolution was about. Unfortunately, the Articles of Confederation weakened the federal government, and that's why Hamilton and Washington and others fought for a constitutional convention to increase the powers of the central government. These Republicans running around saying our founding fathers were against a central government, they're completely wrong. They wanted a government that would stand up for the little man against the private interests.
Well, you had Hamilton, unfortunately, getting in that duel, and then you...
Killed by the guy who founded Chase Manhattan Bank,
right.
Aaron Burr.
And then and Thomas Paine, who proposed medical care for everyone.
Yeah.
Quite a number of very enlightened people, aside from the supposed brilliance of the pederasty of Thomas Jefferson and all of that. Washington Jefferson, I mean, there was eight presidents who were slave masters. And so you had this kind of division which shows itself today in the corrupt
state. Still exists, exactly.
Yeah.
Augie, we're still dealing with the problem of the Confederacy,
right,
which claims states' rights over the power of the central government, which was decided very early by Washington and Hamilton in the report on the National Bank, where the Supreme Court ruled on behalf of the implied powers of government to act for the general interest.
The longer you, well, right now you've got, in the North, you've got Indiana, which is a right-to-work state, and I think Wisconsin is on the cusp of that position.
Under Walker, yeah.
Under Walker. So people are walking into a buzzsaw of corporate power when you take away the workers' rights for free bargaining and all of that. And Reagan started this thing when the air controllers refused to go to work, and he fired them all, and over a very reasonable thing like safety. Simple safety.
Well, and he was just following the model of Margaret Thatcher in Britain. Because the British were the first to go with this deregulation, with the so-called Big Bang in 1985 of deregulating the City of London. But, you know, this comes back to the point we started with. How do you get a break in this? Because there are plenty of people in the Congress who know we're going in the wrong direction, including some Republicans. There are plenty of people around the country who are unhappy. This is why the anti-Wall Street polemic of Elizabeth Warren has become so popular, and why Bernie Sanders is drawing big crowds. And even now on the Republican side, a lot of the so-called Tea Party initially started because of their opposition to government bailouts of the Wall Street banks and the phony health care plan called Obamacare. So is there a potential coalition that could be pulled together to break the power of these corporations? And that's why we're calling on Hillary Clinton to come clean on Benghazi. Tell the truth about what Obama did. If it means the end of her campaign, so be it. Why do you want a presidential candidate who's going to lie to protect what's already been done that's wrong?
She almost seems half-hearted to me. And being a friend of Donald Trump, she has to raise her eyebrows at some of the things he said. And
I think that's an interesting point. There's a column by Justin Raimondo a couple weeks ago talking about how there may well be coordination between Trump and the Clinton campaign. Certainly Trump is a sitting time bomb in the Republican Party. We'll see what happens in a couple of days of that first debate.
The allegation is that all that he's doing is taking power away from the remaining little ducks, and that they'll all quack around Jeb, and everything will be happy again. But unless he chooses to run a third party, sorry.
And if he runs a third party, that would be an interesting situation, because he'd basically be a Ross Perot. He would take away votes, or he'd be...
Well, that's a bit...
He would take away votes from the Republicans.
Bush did not lose the election because of Ross Perot.
And the same thing that happened in the Bush election, that he did win. We had a third-party candidate running.
Well, you know, I think the Trump thing is worth following, but I think the important point that we're bringing out at LaRouchePack, and I'd like to just call your readers' attention to our website, which is LaRouchePack.com. If people want to get more information on anything we've been discussing, whether it's Glass-Steagall or the 28 pages or the complete insanity of U.S. policy, we haven't even taken up, by the way, Augie, the Obama support of a regime in Kiev which is crumbling, because from the very beginning it relied upon neo-Nazi militia units to pull the coup against Yanukovych and put NATO now on the border of Russia, which is seen by the Russians as a provocation. So, you know, we've got to have a shift. It's not going to come about with a Jeb-Hillary election. And so we've got to do whatever we can to break up that so-called inevitable Jeb-Hillary election. Whether it's Hillary coming clean on Obama, or, look, I'll tell you, Bernie Sanders and O'Malley, even though they pay lip service to Obama, they're attacking most of the Obama policies. They're both for single-payer Medicare extension as opposed to the Obamacare policy. They're both opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They're both opposed to arming forces in the Middle East and backing the Saudis. So we're seeing a move to the post-Obama era. I'd just like to see that start now rather than in January 2017, because I think it's dangerous to keep a person in power who's so beholden to these corporate interests.
Remember the movie? Harley, I remember we were talking yesterday. I mentioned the movie with Warren Beatty, and it's so similar to Trump, what he's doing.
Yeah.
And I can't recall, Blue Heart or Blow Hard or something like that. But that film demonstrated what good acting can do, and that's why I think that maybe...
Well, and Trump is allowed to get away. He's given so much latitude by the press,
right,
which they wouldn't give to anyone else.
But I think that the paranoia that's got to be rippling through the Republican Party is just absolutely immense at this point. If Hillary should fall away at some point, she looks weary to me. She doesn't look. Her speeches are okay, but her weariness to me just emanates out of her.
You know, there is an element there where it does look half-hearted.
Yeah.
By the way, the Warren Beatty movie is called Bullworth.
Bullworth, there you go.
Yeah.
That's what it was, yeah.
And but what you're dealing with in the Clinton campaign is an attempt to rely on a certain nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that we're so nostalgic for the years of Clinton or for Bush, both of them created financial bubbles that popped at the end of their regimes. And the idea that was a recovery is just not true. We need a recovery based on very large expenditure on infrastructure, high-speed rail, modernization of the water and power management in this country, the waste management, go back to space program of Kennedy. These kinds of things will create productive jobs at good wages.
Well, you
know, not the 13 million jobs that are temporary, part-time, and low-wage that we've had since 2009.
This country was really built originally because of the Transcontinental Railroad, and then the connecting of all the major cities by some form of rail and electric transportation.
Absolutely, and government played a leading role in that. And you can even go back to the beginning of our country, where we had a debt crisis that was resolved by Hamilton with his report on manufacturers, which included bridges, ports, roads, and canals.
Yeah, the point I guess I was going to make is that it went so far as to where, when a railroad was connected to a town or the train was going by too often with nobody being picked up. Some of the towns in those early days and in the early 1900s started putting up circuses and carnivals and Ferris wheels and things like that to get the visual interest of the public in the, in the involvement so that they would hang around and make a community. So this is, this thing is a good thing, and that's why we need the rail. I took the train out west, at least I thought I did.
Yes, okay, put you on in a second, okay?
From Chicago to Portland, and then from Portland up to Seattle. And all I got was Portland to Seattle, and I that was a disappointment. The rail system is, Amtrak is deliberately being deprived and made incompetent by our Congress, and as is our post office. So these areas of public service are just being destroyed willingly with the Grover Norquist clowns that run around talking about low debt and low taxes and all that.
We have a caller coming in. Caller, welcome to the Morning Edge.
Yeah, hey, this is Steve in St. Pete.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Not too bad. I wanted to disagree with your guest a little bit. He was talking about what the revolution was all about, and I'd like to say for the record that I think basically the revolution was all about some very, very rich people in this country who basically didn't want to have to give any of it up to anyone else and wanted to continue their genocidal practices against the indigenous population and the continued mistreatment of black people, and they didn't want any outside interference with anybody. There was no noble reason about it or a noble cause or anything like that. It was just about a bunch of nasty rich people wanting to be nasty.
Well, I would agree there were a lot of those, including among the founding fathers, and that's why they made this immoral compromise on slavery. But people like Hamilton and his allies were trying to do away with slavery from the beginning. And the compromise that was made shouldn't have been made. But the idea of breaking from the power of the monarchy to control the currency, credit, and debt of the nation was an idea that was taken up by Lincoln with his greenback policy, by John F. Kennedy in 63 when he went back to treasuries to try and get around the Federal Reserve and the private financial interests. So there is in the Constitution this dual, you might say, side to it. But I think if you look at the preamble to the Constitution, that's what actually defines the nation, the idea of the general welfare, which according to today's rich people is a communist plot as opposed to a noble goal.
Can I tell you that I think that preamble to the Constitution was simply put in there, you know, just as window dressing? I don't think they ever had any intention of sticking to it. They never have, and it's like the treaties they made with the Indians. They never meant one damn one of them. You know,
I'd encourage you to take a look at Hamilton's writings, because I think if you look at the writings of Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, his arguments for the Constitution, you'll see that it was not window dressing. It was a philosophical commitment, which, by the way, was the reason that in the Declaration of Independence, it's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, as opposed to the John Locke conception of life, liberty, and property. That's an important distinction that characterized the view of some of the founding fathers. And I think that's something we have to fight for, that distinction.
We're going to have to kind of disagree. I'm afraid I don't see that there was any good in it, any good. And I'll check out this Hamilton. What, John Hamilton?
No, Alexander Hamilton.
Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's why Hamilton was killed, because Burr was a representative of these banking interests.
Really?
You know, his pistols are on display at the headquarters of Goldman Sachs. And Aaron Burr founded what became Chase National Bank with backing from City of London financiers.
Really? I'll have to check that out. I did not know that.
Well, take a look on our website. We have material on that. It's LaRouchePack.com.
Okay. All right, that's interesting.
Well, there you go.
All right, man.
Well, let me give a number also. If you'd like to pursue this after the program, you can call me at 800-922-2907. You know, I'll take calls. I'll be happy to call you back. And just tell the people who answer the phone you heard this on the Morning Edge, 800-922-2907. 922-2907.
All right, brother. Later, Augie.
Hey. Well, thank everybody for tolerating my car killers. I'm going to show.